Good. I think, or I know, today I'll try to present you some solid-state NMR, how to tailor the Hamiltonian through modulation and demodulation, sort of explain some of the things that we already discussed a few times when at the conference I presented something, and Navin has also presented solid-state NMR. So I try to hear back up a little bit and hopefully try to give you some feeling what solid-state NMR is, what is the challenges with respect to quantum control, and in this way try to make some of what we are speaking about a little bit more understandable. And I think compared to the discussion we had now organizing the weekend, I think that might actually be simple to do. We'll see. So the schedule is, or the outline is, an introduction to NMR very briefly, the motivation why we want to go into to study solids, the challenges of solid-state NMR leading to a control problem, ways to tailor the nuclear spin Hamiltonian to provide information. What we want is obviously extract information out from our nuclear spin Hamiltonian about the spin systems. Dipole recoupling, optimal control methods in the end, depending a little bit on how much time the other parts takes. Very introductory, NMR is a very powerful technique to study molecules in solution, was invented in the 40s, had a very powerful period where it was used to look at organic molecules, identifying organic molecules in solution through their different response to the magnetic field, depending on the electronic environment here. So that led to, so as to say, spectra, where you have resonances, and these resonances possess information about the molecule. The very simple NMR experiment simply just puts the sample into the magnet, use an RF pulse that brings the magnetization down orthogonal to the field. It starts to precess around the field, and what you measure is the precession frequency here that depends on the magnetic field and on the chemical shift of the nuclei. So if you have many nuclei, if in this case two, you have two different resonance frequencies. If you have a protein containing many, many protons, in this case here, you get very complicated spectra with each of these lines here representing different atoms in the molecule. So this is the nice features about NMR. That is what has made NMR very popular in the start as an identification method to identify organic molecules. If you go up to large molecules like this, then you need more advanced techniques. You won't need to use more advanced pulse sequences. Here you have not only one RF pulse, but you have two RF pulses that is separated by a time evolution period in which the spins can start to communicate through J couplings or through space dipole-dipole couplings, leading to cross peaks in this two-dimensional spectra so that you can identify nuclei that are close either in space or close through an electronic a bond, chemical bond. So this leads sort of to the field of protein NMR spectroscopy, and the only things you sort of needed was a static magnetic field that allows things to process in terms of the chemical shifts. You needed J couplings. Also, these can be formulated relatively simple through simple two-spin Hamiltonians, so you can sort of process in another three-dimensional subspace here. You needed an RF field here, and all of it can be described relatively simple in closed 3D subspaces, where the only thing you do is that you solve the equation of motion. This is a Liouville von Neumann equation here. The solution to that one, if the Hamiltonian is not time-dependent, is that you have your density operator propagating in time, depending on the Hamiltonian, the time, and obviously the starting density operator. So you can very easily design an experiment where the RF pulse rotates you around an axis, so the x-axis here brings it down to the transverse plane, and then you have excited your resonances. You can have them evolve now if they're in the transverse plane here under the chemical shift, they rotate here. You can very, very easily calculate this. Likewise, if you have J couplings around, the Hamiltonian is a little bit more complicated, but again, you have very, very easy transformation formula. So it's very, very easy to explain NMR experiments in simple means like this, the Liouville von Neumann equation, the solution to it, and you walk in three-dimensional subspaces. So that has led to the design of obviously not only experiments having a single pulse, but experiments that has many pulses, so we have very, very complicated pulse sequences coming up that allows you to steer what you see in your experiments, 1D spectra, 2D spectra, 3D spectra, and these spectra are interpreted in terms of a computer software to get out molecular structure. So this is obviously NMR very briefly, but that is sort of what has been driving NMR into to the study of proteins. That has been discussed by talks by for example Stefan here, how, much more what you could do in liquid state NMR. That is not the topic here, so I'll leave this one and say, well, why do we want to go into to study things in the solid state? Because in the solid state you have many more problems, so as to say, and those we have to cope along with. We want to do the same things as we do in liquid state NMR. So that's the sort of the problems we want to discuss. And reason for doing this is that we want to study, for example, membrane proteins, what is happening in our biological membranes. There the molecules doesn't tumble very fast, and that leads to effects in NMR spectra. We don't get narrow lines, we get very broad lines. I'll discuss the origin of this. You can say about half the turnover in the pharmaceutical industry targets ion channels and receptors that is sitting in the cellular membranes. So getting structural information out about these could be a strong motivation to do NMR structural biology in a space where the molecules doesn't tumble freely as they do in solution. It could also be you wanted to study what happens when proteins misfold and form plaques like that you, for example, see in Alzheimer's disease, where you have proteins that is in the solution, they start to aggregate and they form these amyloid fibrils. Here is a fibril structure determined by solid-state NMR. So that could also be a motivation to try to get a structural basis for understanding what is going on in biological misbehaviors, like, for example, formation of plaques in relation to, for example, Alzheimer's. So this is sort of the motivation. There's many, many more examples, obviously, why we want to do this, but we just want to go into the to a state where the molecules doesn't talk fast. Yes?
These structures can be that different from just the protein.
It is protein structures, but
yeah.
But obviously what you want to do is to find out how the structure is in the environment where the proteins actually are. So now if you want to study the function of proteins in the membrane, then you and do functional studies along with this, then you have to study them in the environment that they are in. So everything is, you can consider the membrane a solvent for the protein, and it only functions when it sits in the membrane. And therefore, if you do what many people want to do, just take them out of the membrane, study them by X-ray diffraction in crystals or something like that, you risk, I'm not saying that's wrong to do, but you risk that you don't get information about the structure and dynamics in the environment where they actually are operating.
Some proteins only have structure inside the membrane. If you take some out, they become random.
Yeah, or they aggregate because they don't like that. This is a hydrophobic environment. That is an environment where the proteins that is here don't like to be out in water. So you have to put them into something that mimics this hydrophobic environment, and that could be you then dissolve them in alcohol or something like that. But then that might change the structure. In liquid state NMR, it's well known that if you change the solvent, you can very easily get different structures. Some solvents promotes alpha helical formation, for example. So the environment is important. Therefore, we want to go in and study them in the right environment. Likewise, if you want to study these fibrils, they are simply too big to tumble fast in liquid state NMR, for liquid state NMR. So you can't study those with liquid state NMR. And X-ray, they don't form crystals. So you can't do it by X-ray. There's amyloid fibril structures discussed in the literature from X-ray, but it's not fibrils, it is crystals. So that is, but it's important obviously to set the ground. Why are we doing this? Because as you'll see in the next slides here, obviously we pay a price to having these ambitions. We have a normal liquid state NMR spectrum here, it's something like 5,000 hertz wide. We have a lot of resonances, it looks not easy to solve this in terms of structure because you have to assign all these to atoms in your molecule, but that can be done with these advanced multidimensional techniques. If you do the same thing in solid state NMR, the spectrum looks something like this. And it's not true that it looks like this, actually. You have to look at the integrated intensity So this one, it would not be up here, but it would be down in the baseline. You don't see anything at all. And that is due to the fact that the molecules doesn't tumble very fast, and that means that you get in orientation nuclear spin interactions, and that is what I'll try to explain in the next slides. So what happens is that the chemical shift reflects the electronic environment of the nuclei, and this electronic environment is not spherical, symmetric, it is orientation dependent. What happens in liquid state NMR is that the molecules tumble extremely fast, so this sort of this asymmetry here is averaged out, and you get one resonance that is what we call an isotropic chemical shift. But if you put this fragment here into a solid, and it's rigid relative to the magnetic field, so you put it into to the magnet, and the molecule is oriented in a certain way, well, depending on the orientation of this electron cloud here, you'll get different resonance positions. So now the resonance position doesn't tell so much what it is for a functional group, but it tells more what is the orientation of this so-called chemical shielding tensor here relative to the magnetic field. Here it's oriented with, here it's oriented in a different angle, here it's oriented in a third angle. All of them, those give different NMR spectra. And if we have a sample that we typically have that has all orientations at the same time, then we get a broad resonance like this. And that is one of the reasons why we get a broad resonance like this. Every of these resonances here get much broader.
So you argued a second ago that these structures don't move as fast as they do in the liquid.
Exactly.
And then you, and I understand that slide, it says that the fact that things are tumbling in the liquid gives you the broadening.
No. But the tumbles in the liquid gives an averaging of this broadening. So if you take this one here and rotate this very fast, gigahertz frequencies, you can't see what is up and what is down.
Right.
So it gets a spherical representation. You know, you only get sort of the trace of the interaction. You only get the isotropic part of the interaction. So in liquids, when it tumbles very fast, you only get one resonance frequency, and that could be here. As soon as you put it into a magnetic field where the molecule doesn't move anymore, then it depends on how is the molecular axis. So if you have a CC bond or whatever you have here, if it's oriented like that, it gives one resonance frequency. If it's oriented like this relative to the field is going here, then it'll give another resonance frequency. Is it something like this? It has another one again. So the fact that it doesn't tumble gives rise to the broadening. So it's opposite.
So in the common, is that opposite called motion now?
You can say that.
What you see in the liquid, because it's moving and actually narrows the spectrum, because you've got maybe to make it clear, this is for a powder.
Well, this is not. Well, these are for different orientation of the molecule. This is for a powder where you have all orientations at the same time.
That's why in the end you have this broad line, because it's thousands of lines next to each other.
Yes. That is important. You could do, and if we want to do like X-ray people, if we want to look at crystals, we could look at a crystal, and then you'll get very narrow lines. The problem is now then you have to assign these lines in a different way than you do in liquid state NMR, because in liquid state NMR, the resonance frequency is more an expression for the functional group. It could be a CH3 group relative to a CH2 group or something like that. That's not the case anymore. Now it depends more on the orientation of the molecule. But in principle, you could do it by doing single crystal NMR spectroscopy. You'll get narrow lines also. But that is not what we want, because crystals can be stored by X-ray. That's fine. They're very, very good at this. We can never beat them in that. What we want to study is things that is not crystal. It is uniform orientation of the molecules. Likewise, if you have a direct nuclear spin interaction between two spins, a dipole-dipole coupling. In liquids, that averages out, and you can see it. This dipole-dipole coupling is proportional to 1 over r to the power 3, and it's proportional to an angle, the angle between the magnetic field and the dipole-dipole axis. In liquid state NMR, when the molecules tumble very fast, the average of this one here will be zero. But if it's the molecule is fixed relative to the magnetic field, you'll see a splitting, like a normal J splitting. And if you have a powder, then you'll get a powder pattern that looks like this. And these ones can be very, very big. These dipole-dipole couplings, if you have two protons, it could be up to 30 kilohertz. So now if we go back again and look at this spectrum here, then each line can be something like 50 kilohertz wide. And now if the whole spectral range is only 5 kilohertz, then each line will be 10 times as broad as the spectral window you have. And that gives rise to this broadening. So in general, in liquid state NMR, we are blessed with, we have, for example, if you have only chemical shifts, we have very, very narrow lines. If we have chemical shifts and J coupling, that is electron-mediated coupling between the nuclei, these can split up in doublets like this. In solid state NMR, we also get, in addition to the isotropic values, we also get chemical shielding and anisotropy in. That gives broadening of the lines. It could be that you also have dipole-dipole couplings in. That gives further broadening of the lines. So that is what we are facing in solid state NMR. That is, we move from these very, very nice lines into something that is broad. That destroys the resolution. That destroys our abilities to extract information about the system. Because if you can't resolve resonances, you don't have any chance. So what I want to bring you through now is that we have somehow to deal with the Hamiltonians that we have, that they are not necessarily isotropic. We have to look at the spatial part of these Hamiltonians. We have to look at the spin part. The spin part for the chemical shift is a normal IZ operator here. For the dipole-dipole coupling, it could be a IZ-SZ. And these spatial dependencies here can be expressed in terms of some Fourier series like this, and that is what I'll try to explain. What is this? This is depending on the size of the interactions. It depends on how fast we are spinning the samples and things like that. If we start to come up with solutions to that, the samples are the molecules are not moving. That is that we introduce sample rotation. So let's try to look at it. If we take a chemical shielding tensor, it is typically described in a coordinate system. You can put the molecule somewhere in some coordinate system, and you can express the chemical shielding interaction, this tensor here, in terms of a matrix like this. This is not representative for the size of this matrix here, so very often what we do is that we bring this tensor into a coordinate system where it is oriented with the principal components along different axes. That means that this tensor gets diagonal. So that is sort of the values we need to know for the chemical shift. If you take the trace of this and divide by 3, then you have the isotropic chemical shift. If you take different linear combinations, you get some information about the broadening and the shape of the NMR spectrum. So all the anisotropic interactions we treat like tensors of this kind here. That describes the orientation dependency. And this depends obviously on the location in the molecule here. These tensors here might have a certain orientation. If you have, for example, a C8 bond and you have two other C8 bonds, it could be this tensor has a certain orientation relative to the molecular frame. And actually this part is very important in the sense that these tensors are not only for the bat. If you can determine them and determine not only their size but also their orientation, you can get very, very important structural information. So I would say it's dual here. We have broadening, we don't like it. But we also have a lot of information. So if we can handle it, if we can tailor the Hamiltonian in the right way and get this information out, we get very, very important structural information out. So what we have to do is somehow to go from this principal axis frame here into that is related to our molecule, into the fact that we put our sample, that is many molecules with different orientations, into a rotor or into a sample container, that is where we do the experiment. So we have somehow to transform these tensors here from the principal axis frame up to the laboratory frame where we are sort of working. In the laboratory frame, we typically have the magnetic field along the z-axis. To do this, it is convenient to express the Hamiltonian in terms of irreducible spherical tensor operators. That is that for each tensor, you take these Cartesian tensors here and bring them into irreducible tensors here where you have these 9 elements represented in a different way. The isotropic value, you have a scalar here that represents, for example, the isotropic chemical shift. And you have some tensors here of different size here, second rank tensor here that describes.
Have you ever seen the R1 components of common spin systems? Because there are rumors in the community that they do exist, but it never went beyond rumors.
I can say so far I didn't see them, and I have heard the same rumors, but whether So
I always symmetrize my tensors, and I suppose you do as well.
We do as well. So we disregard this part here. The only thing I just wanted to bring across here is that it is convenient to re-express. This is only just linear combinations, obviously, into tensors of this kind here, because then we have easier transformation properties, I suppose. Because that's what, as you'll see, much of what we have to deal with is transformations from different one coordinate system to another, to a third, etc., to explain our experiments. So, in general, we can express our Hamiltonians as some fundamental constant. That could be geomagnetic ratio, things like that. A spatial part, that is a tensor of this kind. A spin part, that is a tensor of this kind. And what I want to address attention to now is the spatial part here. And I don't want to draw attention to the scalar part here, because the scalar part is obviously invariant relative to transformations. What I want to address attention to is this part here that contains all the anisotropy of our system. So these tensors we can transform with Wigner rotations, Wigner rotation matrices. That is, that we typically say, well, if we go from our principal axis frame, we first rotate alpha around the z-axis of the principal frame. Then we get a new y-axis. We rotate beta around this y-axis. And we rotate then gamma around this new z-axis. So that is a way to bring an object from one coordinate system to another one. And that is done very conveniently with the beta rotation matrices here that express the dependency on the alpha angle, the first angle around z, the beta angle that is around the new y-axis, and the gamma angle that is around the new z-axis. So we can bring these tensors, if we know them in a certain frame, we can bring them to a new frame. So if we know them in the principal axis frame, we can bring them into the molecular frame, for example. All this, I think, is known, that we do these transformations. So what we want to do is that we know all these tensors here. We have different interactions, different carbons, nitrogens in the molecule here. All of these has different chemical shielding tensors. And those we want to bring from their principal axis frame, that is where they are diagonal. We want to bring them into a molecular reference frame, that could be the molecule here. We want to bring them into a frame of a rotor if we want to rotate the sample. And we want to bring this rotor into a laboratory frame, that is where we do the experiments. That is why we need these Wigner rotations, that is, we need all these transformations and we need to get track of what we are doing. And through this, we can get understanding what is happening in our experiments and what can we do to solve this broadening problem. So it's complicated, but we need to do it. So we do these Wigner rotations, we know everything in the principal axis frame. We rotate into the coordinate system of the molecule, that is with the first Wigner rotation. We rotate further into a frame that is located with our sample container, the rotor. This is the next Wigner transformation. And we rotate again, the last one down to our laboratory frame with the next one. So that is sort of how our spatial tensor, we know it in the principal axis frame, now it's generated in the laboratory frame. And we know that is what we measure. So we need to do this. Obviously, I don't want to bother you with all these angles. There's many angles in this one here. What I want to do is to emphasize the last transformation, because there's obviously a reason why I introduce this. Let's go back. One more. There's obviously a reason why I introduced this rotor here. This rotor here is intended to simulate fast molecular motion. If we spin our samples very fast, it could be we get high resolution spectra again. That is what we want to do. So what I want to emphasize here is the last transformation here. This transformation here, it could be if we choose our rotation angle, the angle between the rotor axis and this one here in a clever way, and if we spin the sample sufficiently fast, it could be we can get our lines narrowed. And that is exactly what we sort of can see out from this expression here. It's not completely clear to you right now, but what we say is, let's assume that we know how the tensor looks in the rotor frame. It'll get modulated by the beta angle, that is the reduced Wigner element here that depends on the angle between the rotor and the laboratory frame, this way here, and it's modulated by the rotation around the laboratory, about the rotor axis, that is the first rotation here. So we rotate first around this one here, that's the first Wigner rotation, that is your alpha. Then you rotate from this one up to the laboratory frame, that is your beta dependency here. That is the two angles I want to focus on here. So this is the setting. Everything is complex here. We move, as I mentioned here, from the principal axis frame of the individual interactions we have into a molecular frame. We move into a water frame here. There's many molecules that have different orientations, so we need to average over a large number of orientations here. Put them in the have them now in the rotor and transform that into a laboratory frame. That is what is needed. This is the path we need to go through to understand what solid state and my experiments are doing.
What's the difference between a principal axis frame and a molecular frame? I thought the principal axis frame was in each molecule.
That's not each molecule. It's each interaction. So if you have a dipole-dipole coupling, the set axis of the principal axis frame is along the bonding axis. And this bonding axis is obviously different from this bonding axis. Likewise, the various chemical shielding tensors have different orientation relative to the molecule. So you need to transform all of these into the molecule. Then you have a common frame. And now you have one molecule, but this you don't have only one molecule, you have many molecules with different orientation.
Defining axis then for the molecular frame.
You can choose. Yes. So that is the complexity of the system. So all the interactions will be transformed into a common frame. Then you have many molecules, different orientations. That is why we do need to do what we call powder averaging. This powder averaging, all these different orientations, was exactly what gave us the broadening. We have these very broad lines. That is that we have many different orientations of the molecule. So now we put everything into the rotor and we try to explore what is going on here in the last part. I hope it's okay to. I just tried to explain some of the complexity of the system.
Do you account for the fact that you can have multiple orientations in a crystal cell? So if you've got multiple molecules, for instance.
That you could also do. You could also add different molecular sets here. So that we in this picture we don't, but that could obviously be done also. So that you just add an extra frame here. So.
But if you average your sink, what's the difference? You already lost.
If you average everything.
Yes. So
what you can say, obviously.
You lost all the information.
Averaging doesn't compute with the simulation.
Okay, that's one way to put it. What you obviously can say is that every principal axis frame here can just average, sort of add all of these together, and then you'll have one transformation that brings them up here. That's fine. Everything is fine. And that'll be valid. But then you don't get any insight. What we want to get in is to try to find out, can we do something with these tensors here by putting them, for example, into a rotor, rotating this one very fast? Is that sufficient? What we're up against is that the molecule moves with gigahertz frequencies. It's very, very difficult to do that. That's Brownian motion. It moves very, very fast. That is what we want to compete with. So what we have in a very simple setup is that it could be that if we put all our molecules, all these things here, into a rotor and rotate this one here, that we can mimic this averaging effect. That is what we want to do. This is obviously a naive thing to think that you, by rotating around one axis and rotating in few hertz frequencies, kilohertz perhaps, that you can mimic what is going on when molecules tumble much faster. But obviously I do this because there's a solution to this. It has been proven that this works. I just want to explain how it works. So again, focus on this last part here. And then it could be something comes up.
So the basic idea is to still come back and predict the structure of the molecules that are giving you the smears at this point, right?
Yes. The first thing to do this, the first step to do this is all this broadening has an enormous structural information. The width of these chemical shielding patterns, the dipole-dipole interactions, how it contains information, how long things are from each other.
But what showed us look like all the information washed away.
Exactly. So we have a lot of information, but it's broadened so we can't see anything. That is why we want to first, before we do this, we want to establish high-resolution spectra so we can get it out. That is why we do magic angle spinning. We get high-resolution spectra. So look at, see, it helps. So when we put it into a rotor here, we put the sample into a rotor here. We incline that one with respect to the magnetic field by an angle that is what we call the magic angle, and it is really magic. At least I think from our discussion here, it has to be expressed as a magic that you can bring this spot line here into a very narrow line. By putting things into a rotor here, having this at exactly this 54.7 degrees, that's half a tetrahedral angle. But if you do this, and you express your Hamiltonians like some coefficient, we don't care right now what they are, but they have a modulation frequency that came out from what I showed before, e to the im omega rt. They have a modulation frequency. That was what we got out from all these transformations. That was, we got one single angle here, sort of a single thing here that pertained this modulation, I to I, m omega rt, omega r is
theoretical, not empirical. I mean,
it's theoretically completely solid. Or what do we? Right now, you can argue here. The structure is contained in these ones here. Now I assume we know them. But these are only constants here. It doesn't matter at all. Those is obviously what we want to determine in the last, in the end. They contain the structure information. But we don't care right now. The only thing we care about now is to get higher resolution spectra. Then I'll show you afterwards how we get it back again. So I show now a very complex way to remove complexity from the spectra. Then I'll show you something that along the same lines reintroduces part of the information, but at our will, how we want to do it. So as you can see here, you can definitely see from the spectra here that by putting them into a rotor here, rotating this faster and faster, if you don't rotate it, zero frequency here, rotation frequency, 100 hertz, 200 hertz, 300, 400, 600, 800, 1 kilohertz, 2 kilohertz. And you can, with rotors nowadays, you can spin up to 70 kilohertz. So you can rotate the samples with up to 70,000 revolutions per second. That is the limit here for these rotors here is that the speed at the outer end, edge here, can't exceed the speed of sound. We can't go supersonic. That is the limitation. But we can run these ones here with up to the speed of sound. That provides narrowing. You can see you get high resolution spectrum.
How does it look at things other than the magic angle?
Well, if you don't do it at the magic angle, then you'll get broadening. And that is what I want to show you in the next slide. Why is it we should select exactly this magic angle? Why is that selected? So let's try to see if that comes across. So now at least I got you some expressions here that we can express all interactions. That could be the chemical shift or the dipole-dipole interaction in terms of some coefficients here, and then a modulating term like this one here, that is the set rotation around the rotor axis. I guess that is okay. I hope so, at least. Then we can try to see the impact of this Hamiltonian on our density operator here. So what is important is this rotation angle here, and that is, why doesn't this work? That is related to this integral of this coefficient here. So this is the rotation angle here. So what we want is, by magic angle spinning, removing this one, we sort of will average this effect of the dipolar coupling. We want to average this one. If that's zero, we don't see the broadening anymore. So let's put things into a rotor here. We have two variables here. We have the angle relative to the static magnetic field. We also have the rotor frequency here around the rotor axis. That is sort of the things we have involved. Let's try to look at the Wiener expressions I showed you before and see what does this integral involve into. So this coefficient here, we average this one here. We average that over a rotor period. In this case, it rotates. We average over the rotor period here. If we do this, all the components here with m different from zero will average. The integral is zero. So the only thing we get back is one of the Fourier components. We have five of these, plus minus two, plus minus one, and zero. We only have this one that is not modulated in time. This is looking like the isotropic component. But it is not only containing that isotropic chemical shift, it also contains broadening. This coefficient will look like this. It depends on the Euler angles, and in particular, it depends on this Euler angle here, this Wigner rotation here, and that looks like this. This is half times 3 cosine beta squared minus 1. And now if this angle here is 54.7 degrees, this one vanishes. So everything here, this term here, this rotation angle here, the effect of the Hamiltonian vanishes if we set the magic angle here. So you can do two things. Either you rotate the sample and then you sample stroboscopically. So you sample after one rotor period, another one, a third one. That is what we saw here. Or you can put it just into a rotor and rotate very fast. And the very fast rotation here, if you integrate this, the M coefficients will different from zero will disappear, and you get again this zero component here, and you, that's averaged by adjusting the magic angle. So if you adjust this to the magic angle, everything disappears. That you can see, this is strictly correct calculations, derivations on the transformations we saw before, and you can see at the magic angle, everything disappears. So you get high resolution spectra. And you get that through a manipulation of the spatial part here. So we rotate the sample and we average things up. That is obviously not what we want to do. We get high resolution spectra now, and that's fine. We can work with that. We get spectra that looks like liquid state NMR. That was what I showed. Yeah. If you spin the sample, you get high resolution spectra. So we're back at the level where liquid state NMR starts. You're not convinced.
It looks like you're back somewhere better, because you can tune how, you don't just get the spectrum on the top, you get the full sequence of them.
Well, here I just illustrate what happens if we spin faster and faster. And what I claim here is if you spin very fast, you only get this central line here, you only get the isotropic chemistry. I just illustrate here the effect. So what happens when you start to spin is that you break this up into spinning sidebands.
Yeah, you get the information of how it breaks up and how fast.
Yes, so you can do experiments with different spinning speeds and get this sort of information, but still you have to remember this is only for one line. If you in your molecule have 2,000 lines, then obviously it starts to get complicated again. You'll have all these spinning sideband manifolds, all of them shifted relative to the isotropic chemical shift. So you'll have all the information. But what you have to face is obviously, if you record like this, the integral of the signal is the same. So obviously this one, they are represented in the same height, but this one will obviously be much, much higher because all the integral will be in the center band. So if you would want to do it in a sensitive way, you spin fast. So people spin very fast. They don't only spin these 2 kilohertz, but they spin much faster. They contain information, and that could also be something we want. They contain information about the chemical shielding interaction, the local electronic structure. So they are very rich in information. So that is exactly what I want to go to. Now afterwards, I want to reintroduce some of these, but I just want to reintroduce them at will. I want to have, if you look at the detection dimension, when I detect the signals, I want to have high resolution. The spectrum I want to see. It could be something before that modulates this response in a two-dimensional spectrum that has lower resolution. So I just want to be able to control this Hamiltonian and see that sometimes I want to see an isotropic spectrum and sometimes I want to see the anisotropic effects. That is the art of solid-state NMR. That is destroying information here to get higher resolution. The next is to get it back. That is, but it should be at our control, not at nature's control. Well, we are also nature, I guess, but so you can modulate the spatial part to get high resolution. But you could also modulate the spin part. And that could be necessary, for example, if you have a coupling between a proton and a carbon. And you want to look at the carbon spectrum, but don't want to see the dipolar coupling to the proton spin. It could be that you irradiate on the proton, just irradiate there and average that interaction out. So you also, to get high resolution spectrum, you also have to use RF irradiation to eliminate part of the interaction. So this is what we do when we do what we call decoupling. So we take, we want to observe a carbon spectrum here. We have a Hamiltonian here that contains the chemical shift we're interested in, but also this dipolar coupling. What we do is that we put strong RF on that rotates the spin operator now very, very fast. And if you go into the interaction frame of this RF irradiation, you will see a modulation of your Hamiltonian that looks like this. It has a cosine modulation, so you just stir the Hamiltonian, the set part of the set part of the Hamiltonian that is rotated and gets a rotation frequency. If you average over this rotation period here, then you'll get zero if you average all this. And now you eliminated the Dipler coupling, the coupling between proton and carbons in this case. And that has also an effect on the spectra. So I just the reason for mentioning this is that you can average and eliminate anisotropy in spatial space by rotating the sample, but you can also do it in spin space by rotating the spin operators. So that means eventually static solid, no magic angle spinning, no decoupling, it looks like this. If you start to decouple, just remove the heteronucleic dipolar coupling interaction between carbon and protons, you get better resolution. If you do magic angle spinning and rotate just to eliminate chemical sealing anisotropy and part of the dipolar coupling, you get something like this. If you do the combination between these two, both magic angle spinning and this heteronuclear decoupling, you average both in spin space and spatial space, you get high resolution spectra that looks like liquid state analog spectrum. So we have tools at our hands. We manipulate the Hamiltonian in space, spatial space, and in spin space. And if we do that and combine this in a clever way, we get very nice spectra. And again, remember, our modulation frequencies are very, very slow compared to what nature does with this Brownian motion. So I think it's actually fantastic that we can do it with a few kilohertz spinning and a little bit RF on some of the spins, and then you get high resolution spectrum.
Are what happens to the sideband peaks in the?
In this case, the sideband here, it is not spinning extremely fast.
I mean, they always show up, you always know the frequency they're at, so you
know exactly, they always flank, you have the isotropic chemical shift, they always come with a rotor frequency, two times, three times, you know exactly where they are. So what you want is obviously to avoid that these the side bands from these groups here, for example, from these carbonyls here, they don't go into the Alephac region.
That's what I was getting at, when you have, you said like 1,000 lines or 2,000 lines, how do you keep your side bands from?
But typically, you spin. Ideally, you spin so fast that you don't see any sidebands. Then you won't have the problem. If you spin slower, then obviously you have to consider where they are. But you would typically place them places where you don't have any information. So here, no problem. Here, that's outside the spectral window. So you can place them by selecting the spinning speed so that it fits. Okay.
Computers cannot do it instead of all of these procedures. Just you have all information, yeah? Now it's good for our eye to see it, but...
You don't have the information. That is what we want to get at.
You all this procedure, you don't have everything, so let computer do it for you and do the...
But you can't deconvolute. If you can, but I cannot at least. But if you can, it'll be very good. I can't deconvolve this one here in terms of this one.
You can.
No, I can't. But so I would say the computer doesn't help us too much. Obviously, the simulations, whatever I have shown, many simulations, obviously Simpson can do, this program we use for it can do everything. But I think in respect, what we want is to get information out from our molecules.
Yeah, well, my first expectation was that you were going to try to fit the top spectrum to some coefficients, the Euler angles, etc.
Yes.
But no, you're actually.
But that is what we want to attack. Is what? Yeah, that is important. What you can do is you have a big molecule, then you can prepare it, for example, with one carbon 13 label in. So you only see that. That's the spin isotope you see in NMR with carbons. Only have one. Then obviously you get a broad spectrum that only reflects one side. Then you get the information out. But if you have 2,000 carbons, you can't get it out. So what I want here is to do something we can work on all spins at the same time.
So is this a technique that the other people in the room have seen before?
It's a billion-dollar industry.
It is.
What Chris, what Niels Christian is explaining is just how it works. There's no question about
that. No, but it's not.
This is
started yesterday.
No. Well, not yesterday. It's long time ago. This. I want to add on, this is only the introduction. but to sort of go further on and explain what we can do to get the information back, and that is what you are called for. Then obviously we have to first remove it, get high resolution spectra, say we have set the ground to do high resolution NMR in solids. That is what we have here. So that we have so far. So now obviously we want to get it back again. So we want to determine the orientation and size of all these tensors here. We want to measure all the internuclear distances. Remember, the dipole-dipole coupling was inversely proportional to the distance to the power 3. You can do that also in liquid state MR, but that doesn't, you don't see the dipole coupling directly in liquid state MR. It comes through relaxation. And that is 1 over the power r to the power 6. So it's much, much shorter distances. In solid state MR, you have the chance to see these effects directly.
Is this drawn by your little program that you've got on your site?
Yes. I don't know whether it's little, but it is there at least.
Similar for EPR. Have you got the source code available?
Yes, yes, it's open source.
Okay.
Yes. SimMole is called. Yes.
Because my students trying to make something that would be very interactive, so you would actually rotate those tensors on the screen.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't think it does it at the moment.
No.
Yeah. So we might adapt some of your code.
Of course, it's open source. It can be used forever. So we want to get all this back again, because if we can measure the distances, we have the structure. If we have all distances, we have the structure. If we have all the orientations of these tensors here, we have much more. We have not only the nuclear structure, we also have the electronic structure. I think this is, solid state MR has the potential to do what no other technique can do. If we can solve this problem, getting all this information out, we'll have fantastic structure. We'll have fantastic information about local dynamics and things like that. But now we need to get it back. We've just destroyed all this. So I'm sorry about that. I introduced a frustration here. We destroyed all the information. We want to get it back. So we know that if we put things into a sample, then we rotate the sample very fast, we modulate, everything averages out, we eliminate these dipole-dipole couplings we want to measure. Deep shit. But what we can do is that we can introduce some RF rotations, complicated RF pulse sequences here, that do the same thing, but on the spins, that is on the spin operators. So now here you have a spatial coefficient, I to the m omega rt. If you average this over a rotor period, it vanishes. This is the modulation, the cosine, you integrate, it goes away.
I'm confused about something. Could we go back one small slide? Go back. Yeah. So you said that you got rid of all the information, all this information.
Not all. The isotropic chemical shifts are back. They are still there. That we got high resolution. So
you basically, after you've done all this transformation, that you basically have a spectrum which should be equivalent to a liquid phase.
Yes, simply. Well, it's a little bit broader here in the lines, but right. It's essentially.
But in principle now, it's about essentially a liquid phase.
Yes.
So that means that the internal, these dipole-dipole couplings that aren't present with an average out in the liquid, those are dipole-dipole couplings between different molecules?
Or different nuclei within the same molecule. It's everything.
If the molecule is rigid, even if it's rotating in the liquid, then the dipole relationship should stay constant. No,
because the dipole-dipole coupling tensor is traceless, so as to say. So it averages out. You can see it if you just calculate simply what is two dipoles interacting. You'll get immediately this 3 times cosine squared minus 1 dependency, and if you average that, then you get.
It would be dependent on external magnetic field, but in the external magnetic field.
Yes. Yes. That is important. Yes. The external magnetic field truncates part of the dipole-dipole interaction, and that leads. Yes. So if people do zero field NMR. If you do NMR without the NMR magnet, then you'll get a doublet or triplet, I guess it depends, that you can measure that will come on. We have them in high field to get resolution with respect to the chemical shift, because if you don't have the chemical shift resolution that we can anchor our dipole-dipole interactions to, it's very difficult to.
So it's precisely the presence of the magnetic field which is going to give a direction, and you have your average with respect to that direction.
It's actually a very simple model that you can use, that you can. Classical model, which if you have two little magnets, and now if the orientation is fixed, doesn't matter, you rotate, it's always the same cupping energy, but once you have a very strong external magnet field, they both align with this external magnet because it's dominant effect. Now if you rotate the molecule, they don't rotate like this, but rotate like this,
for example, if we have really two magnets, they will repel each other like this, and they will attract each other if they are in line. And then, now if you average, consider the molecule presumably rotates to first approximation something rigid.
Yeah, then you could say, obviously, now we don't need to get more back. Now we're back at liquid state NMR. Liquid state NMR lives with J couplings and things like that. So that we can also do. But in general, we still have a little bit broadening here. The relaxation things, the signal dies faster. So we want to explore. How can we also measure, for example, the dipole-dipole couplings with this 1/r³ information that is embedded there? So I just want to get the dipole coupling back. We have the chemical shift spectrum now. I want to get the dipole coupling back in certain periods of the experiment. So what we do is that we supplement rotations in spin space by an RF pulse sequence. Don't consider how it looks right now. Just put RF on. We get a modulation here. E to the IP omega RT if we adjust the RF field strength somehow with a constant to the spinning frequency.
It's on a one specific frequency?
It could be broadband, it could be on a specific frequency. It doesn't matter right now. We just consider we have a spin pair and then we put RF irradiation on that has the same modulation frequency, or actually if you look at it has the opposite. So now if you have P equal to minus M, it gets static. So now we have it back. It's not modulated anymore. So what one can say, we have a modulation due to magnetic angle spinning. If we make a demodulation, it just makes this one exactly minus this one. We have demodulated it. Then we get it back. So this is modulation and demodulation. So we can control the Hamiltonian. We can say, I want the dipole-dipole interaction, and we turn it on. Chemical shielding and such, but everything else is away. But we turn a specific interaction on. So that is what I'll call tailoring of the Hamiltonian. We have a Hamiltonian that contains a wealth of information. We tailor it, we modify it so that we can see the parts of it that we're interested in. And dipole-dipole couplings are very, very important for two reasons. One reason, they contain distance information. But also, they're very good to transfer magnetization from one spin to another spin to a third spin. That is what liquid state NMR has used in their three-dimensional experiments. Evolve under one chemical shift, transfer the magnetization via a coupling to another spin, and that evolves in the other dimension. So you get these two-dimensional spectra. So transferring magnetization from spin to spin to spin is the art of NMR. That we can do in solids by reintroducing the dipole-dipole interaction. And this dipole-dipole interaction is much larger than the J couplings you see in liquid state NMR. Between two protons, in liquid state NMR, it could be 10 hertz. In solid state NMR, it could be 25,000 hertz. So we can do it much, much faster and much with much longer range than you do typically in liquid state NMR. So you have the potential to do something, if you can control it, good enough.
So, let me ask a quick follow-up. You start off by saying that in the solid state, you have this very broad spectrum.
Yes.
Now let's say you do magic angle spinning, whatever you get. You know, all that width by averaging over an anisotropic, then that collapses to a fairly narrow line.
Yes.
And so, but now you want that information back.
Exactly.
So,
and that,
so, but that raises the obvious question.
Selectively. Right?
That raises the obvious question. I mean, why if you let's say instead of spinning around exactly the magic angle, you spun around something which is close to the magic angle.
People do that as well.
People do it as well.
And presumably, right, you would collapse, but not completely. And then you'd have something which is narrow enough to see, but still would have residual information about that.
If you misadjust the angle by 1/1000th of a degree, 1/100th of a degree.
Yep.
It's very, very small. Then you get small residual effects back. And that you could also use. But I think the point here...
That being considered a kind of a modulation?
People actually do it. They put piezoelectric actuators on that angle, and they selectively alter it.
Okay. But look here. If you have a spectrum that is extremely many, many, many lines here, just an additional small broadening, you don't want this. So actually what you want to do is to do an experiment where you have a T1 evolution period here. Then you turn on your dipole-dipole couplings. Dipole, dipole. That makes a transfer from one spin to another one. Then you record again one at high resolution. So in these two periods here, you have the magic angle. And it's very difficult just to, in the experiment, it's very, very short time you have here. You don't change the magic, you don't change the angle, the rotor angle. It's better to turn on the dipolar couplings here in this period here by putting on some RF in this period. So that is what we want to do. But I agree with you, we can obviously just miss it, adjust the angle a little bit, but that also makes resolution here is the driving force. So that is the reason why people buy magnets that is costing $7 million or something like that. That is to get a little bit more resolution. They are extremely expensive.
But what is the difference between them?
So that means eventually, now if you have this very, very good dispersion of lines, you don't want to miss at the angle a little bit to go down to a 400 megahertz magnet if you have the money to buy a 900. So you don't want this extra in most cases. Could be in special cases where you don't have many lines, that's a very good thing and people do it. But in many cases, most cases, you want to have the optimal resolution here and here to get a two-dimensional spectrum that gives resolution like you see in liquid state, if it can. So that, yes?
Haven't you made the dipolar coupling go away by decoupling?
Well, in this case here, I'm just saying magic angle spinning, in this case here, it could be carbon-carbon couplings. They are 2 kilohertz. If you spin 10 kilohertz, they are away. You spin much faster than the dipolar coupling, they are away. Then I put the RF on, reintroduce them. So in this case, I didn't decouple. In this case, I'm just spinning the sample, getting rid of the dipolar couplings. Could be carbon-carbon couplings. Spinning 10 kilohertz, they are away.
I'm thinking of your earlier slide where you did, if here's how it appears if you just do magic angle spinning, and here's how it appears if you just do decoupling, and here's how it appears if you do both. And the decoupling, exactly. What did that specifically get rid of?
Your spin systems are very complex. You have protons, you have carbons, you have many things here. So what I talked about in magic angle spinning, that was I eliminated all anisotropic interactions essentially. It was not good enough. I put decoupling on here, so I eliminated also the coupling to these ones.
Okay,
so I decoupled here on the proton channel. I put a proton RF on. But what I'm recoupling now, as an example, is the couplings between these two. It could also be between carbon and nitrogen. So obviously, it's much more complicated. It's a matter. It's many, many spins interacting, and you have to consider turning on and off which of them. That is an issue. In this case, what I'm talking about is turning on, for example, between a carbon and a carbon, or a carbon and a nitrogen. So we still use decoupling, but that is on another channel. That is on the protons in this case. So obviously, you don't put recoupling on at the same time as decoupling on the same channel. You can do it by simple pi pulses. You just look at the Hamiltonian, that model is like this. You put a pi pulse in the middle, you turn the Hamiltonian up, and start to get a power tracking. So you can do it by simple means, RF that is sort of synchronized so that you can eliminate the time dependency completely, or you can also do it with sort of pi pulses that inverts the Hamiltonian at certain time periods. So by doing this, you have the possibility here, you do magic angle spinning, you get something like this, high-resolution spectra. You put some RF, and now if you do two-dimensional spectra here without doing anything with RF, you'll get a spectra that only has the dipole. There's no transfer between the spins. But if you put RF on in synchrony with the rotor resolution, you start to get transfer between spins, and you start to get your cross peaks. And now you're back where you can do similar things as in liquid state NMR. You can do two-dimensional spectra where things are correlated, not through J-couplings, but through dipole-dipole couplings. And those you reintroduced in between the detection dimension and the indirect dimension in the experiments. So you get back to what you could do with liquid state NMR, just here based on dipole-dipole couplings. So the intensity of these peaks here depends on the distance between the two nuclei that gives rise to this cross peak. So that gives rise to solid state NMR spectra that looks like liquid state NMR a little bit broader and things like that. So you can start to do the same things as you do in liquid state NMR. I don't know how long, obviously I have many more slides, but I think we shouldn't do it too long, and it could also be that the message is, so this is sort of giving the scaffold, we can continue, but I don't know, I think already we talked.
We need another talk next week, it would be perfect to continue this, yes, if you have enough, I'll do that.
Yes.
It's up to you. Completely up to you. I just think somehow this is complex, and I don't know why. For the NMR people, obviously, it's sort of an interesting journey, but it could also be for others. It's too much mystery. I don't know. It's up to you.
Because the optimal control clocks are spin plus another spin, and this is hundreds of spins, and this is where it's used to great effect.
I just think if I continue for another half hour or something like that, it would be completely lost.
Anyway, we will be lost.
Okay.
But then normally we go for an hour and a half, and we started 15 minutes late because we were talking about social things.
Yes.
So you're okay for now. We can go until 2:15.
Okay, perfect. Good, perfect. That's fine. That's fine. Obviously, I prepared it, so I have no hesitation to present it. So let's try to walk through this recoupling experiment as I mentioned, just specifically looking at the Hamiltonian, what is going on. We have chemical shifts here, and we have a Doppler coupling interaction. That is what we have, two spins with each chemical shift and a Doppler coupling interaction. What we wanted to get back was this dipole-dipole coupling. That was what I showed you sort of schematically that we could do by just putting some RF on. Now I will put specific RF on to show you that it's not only a postulate. We put some RF on and then we probably can do it. So I'll illustrate with a very simple experiment. Could be a little bit complex formulas or something like that, but a simple experiment how we do it. That's not the one, that's the one. So the sample rotation destroys this dipolar coupling that we already saw now. It averages the dipole-dipole coupling.
Let me ask a very basic question. Is there any significance to the difference between I and S, the letters?
No, it's just that we have two spins. It could be two hetero spins. Very often in NMR, you use I and S for a heteronuclear spin system, where, for example, the I could be protons and the S could be carbons. But you also see many that it deals with different protons, and they will also call them I and S just to have different letters for them.
I think this is I1 and I2.
Yes. That would be perfectly okay with me. Exactly.
Historically, that was for insensitive and sensitive nuclei. It's only example.
But it's not because it's typically protons. That is the sensitive nuclei. That's called I.
That was back then when detected the carbon.
Uh-huh. So I didn't know that. So that was why it was I and S. Jesus, I've been in NMR many years, I didn't know that. Okay, good, excellent. So, but in this, yes. Yes, we call them I and S. Exactly. But at least now we saw, we average them. We get zero by spinning. Then we put RF on the two channels, I and S, I1 or I2, whatever you call them. We put RF on these two. Just put RF on. So this is our RF irradiation. That is the one we need to exploit. We could call the amplitudes of these two here. We can sort of relate them to the spinning frequency. Spin with omega R. We can just say some arbitrary number, Q times omega R, P times omega R. They could be anything, integers, whatever. It could be any number. That is obviously valid. We could say that RF, the spinning frequency could be 20 kilohertz, and then this would just be numbers times 20 kilohertz. An angular frequency, but we don't care. So we add in some RF. Through this one, I claim, and that is what I'll show, that we can get a modulation here, e to the I m omega r t, that cancels this one, and everything survived. That was what I postulated in the previous slide. Now we just get into a concrete example. So to do this, we have to obviously consider what should these P and Qs be to achieve exactly this one. So that is what we try to analyze now.
So it's the I S term which is being averaged out.
This is the chemical shift. You also average by spinning the anisotropic part of the chemical shifts. The isotropic part will be left. So what one could say, what I want to focus on here is the dipolar part. So you could have said, why don't
the I S part, the I S term, that averages out from magic angle spinning.
Yes.
And that's the part that you want to get back by
putting
in these
extra.
Yes.
Exactly. So come on. So again, this time here, we put the RF on. if we go into the RF, the interaction frame of the RF, that is, we use a rotation that looks like this. We have the RF propagator here for the S-spin, propagator for the I-spins. We go into an RF interaction frame, sort of taking out the uninteresting part. The RF is not interesting. What we have to find out is how does it manipulate our internal Hamiltonian, that is, our dipolar coupling Hamiltonian. So we go typically into a frame, like you do. You go into the Zeeman, the rotating frame in normal NMR experiment, where you take out the influence from the Zeeman field. You're not interested in the Zeeman interaction. You're interested in the chemical shifts. So typically, you go into a rotating frame, taking out the Zeeman interaction. Likewise, here we go into a rotating frame, taking out the uninteresting part, that is the irradiation. Just look at the manipulation of that on the Hamiltonian we want to look at. That is this one here. That is a normal trick in NMR. It looks like a carousel. You just jump on the carousel and look at it from there.
It's the same in all branches.
I would guess so. But you okay, good. Okay, so this Doppler coupling can be written as these coefficients times e to the I m omega rt. We have seen that already. This RF modulation here gives some cosine modulations to the ZZ term, cosine sine modulation to ZY term, sine cosinus to the YZ term, and sine sine to YY term. So it introduces rotations. These modulations obviously can be expressed in terms of these Euler's formulas, so we can express them in terms of exponential functions, and that is exactly what we want to do. We want to have modulation functions from here, canceling this one here. That is exactly what we want to do. So making this rewrite is obviously possible, and if you do this rewrite, we get a slide that is a little bit more complex. it's not so complex. The only thing we just do is the e to the im, we just have the exponentials for this and this. So obviously you get some exponential that contains both m, p, and q. And that is what we have here. So you have the Fourier components of the Doppler interaction here with these modulation terms. And the only thing you want to do now is just to say, well, those ones we know what are. They have plus minus 2, plus minus 1, or 0. So those we know for the Doppler coupling, there's no 0, but plus minus 1 and plus minus 2. So we just have to match so that we select out P and Q, so that it selects, for example, M equal to 1. Then we have part of the Doppler coupling recoupled. So that is what is done here. If you average over the rotor period here, what will come out is those that is matching where M and P and Q is matched. So you get out Fourier components that looks like this, a Hamiltonian that looks like this. Those are the components of the Doppler coupling interaction. So this is the Hamiltonian when you average. These ones has to be plus minus 1 or plus minus 2. So obviously now you have to adjust these two so that P plus Q is 1 or 2. So you obviously select now P and Q in the right way. So it could be that if you want to have the omega IS1 part here, then you will have P plus Q should be equal to 1. That could be achieved if P was 4 and Q was minus 3, for example. Then you have selected a certain component. And how does that relate to our experiment? Well, it does relate to our experiment in the sense that this was P omega R, this was Q omega R. So now if you adjust them in the right way, so you say that the spinning, the RF amplitude is 4 times the rotor frequency here and 3 here, well, then you'll get a recoupled Hamiltonian. So then you get your Hamiltonian back. So this is the Hamiltonian. It doesn't look like the Hamiltonian we had before. The Hamiltonian we had before was something like 3iz, sz minus I dot s. This one is modulated. This is a sort of a planar Hamiltonian, but we get it back. This one we can work with. So now we have the Doppler coupling Hamiltonian back, but just putting RF on, you have the RF adjusted to the spinning frequency in an appropriate way. Which way, obviously, depends on the scaling factor here, depends on which one you select, whether it's the Fourier component plus minus 1 or plus minus 2. Different scaling factor here. It depends on the Doppler coupling and some Euler angles. And that is what we call the cross-polarization experiment. It was introduced in the early 70s to NMR by Pines in Berkeley, where he said, well, if you have two RF fields that is Hartmann-Hahn matched, that you have the same RF field on carbons and protons at the same time, then you can drive coherent transfer from protons to carbons. That made an enormous splash in solid-state NMR because you suddenly could get sensitivity into low-sensitive nuclei-like carbons. In this case, it's not Hartmann-Hahn match. The match is close to Hartmann-Hahn match. It just differs in the RF field on these two with one rotor frequency. So when you spin the samples, it's not Hartmann-Hahn match. It's not equal fields you put on, but the fields you put on differs with one rotor frequency. If you do that, then you get the dipole coupling back. And you can start to transfer magnetization from one spin to another spin.
I'm not exactly clear. In certain sense, when you describe this experiment, you say that you want to get the coupling, you want to get this dipole-dipole coupling back.
Exactly.
But I don't understand really. I understand that in the presence of this coupling, you'll also get transfer of polarization. But I don't understand whether the transfer of the spin polarization is your goal, or the measurement of the dipole-dipole Hamiltonian is your goal.
That's obviously a relevant question. The typical experiments will provide information on both, because now if you want to transfer from one spin to another and you sort of increase the length of this experiment, you get more and more transfer. So you start out with essentially zero, and then you build up. And then when you're at the maximum, then obviously you get most transfer. So there you obviously want to be if you want to make transfer. But if you want to measure, you just make the time series and then you see the oscillations. And then out from these oscillations, you measure the distance.
So the same arrangement of rotations does both?
So it simply depends on, if you want to do a transfer, you just put it to the maximum. So it depends on the dipolar coupling and time, obviously. So you put it so that you get maximum transfer. If you want to measure the distance, what you can do is you can record a time series, and then see how the buildup is. Or you can say, I just take one value here, like you do in a liquid state by NOSI experiments. You take just one value, and then you say, if the signal is up to 100%, then the distance must be, it might be very close to spins. If it's only coming to half at this certain time, it's further distance, and if you only want a fourth, further distance. So in one experiment, you also get information.
So now, just back to the Pines experiment in the 70s. So what he was looking for was transfer.
It was transfer, and the reason being there that what people wanted to do is to do solid-state NMR. They could do like we do in liquid-state NMR, look at protons. Protons are very, very difficult in solid-state NMR because they have large geomagnetic ratio, so the dipole-dipole couplings are huge. That is 30 kilohertz or something like that. So proton spectrum is very, very difficult to do. So what people wanted to do was carbon NMR. And they wanted to do it natural abundance. The problem with carbon is that it has lower geomagnetic ratio, thereby lower sensitivity by itself. Another problem is that it has very long relaxation times typically. So that means eventually if you do a single pulse and single pulse and single pulse to record it, it can take very long. So what people wanted to do was to do an experiment like an inept experiment in liquid state NMR where they transfer magnetization from protons to carbons, getting the gain of the geomagnetic ratio that is a factor of four between protons. And so you get a factor of four there already, but you can also exploit that the relaxation of protons are faster, so that means you can repeat the experiments much faster. So it could be that you get a factor of 20 or something like that in sensitivity by doing this. So what he was aimed at was simply just introducing things like this to transfer magnetization from the abundant protons to the lower abundance.
Can you just clarify, you said he did Hahn matching in your we're doing something a little different from Hahn matching, but what, if you're both interested in...
He didn't do magnetic angle spinning.
What was he doing?
He didn't do spinning of the sample. At that time, they didn't spin the samples, or they spent, in some cases, they were spinning them very slow. So his theory comes out where you don't modulate the Hamiltonian by the spinning.
Otherwise, if there was magnetic angle spinning, you would have ended up the same thing.
In the first cases where you have proton and carbons and you have a bulk he described it with thermodynamics. And you could also describe it in this way here. When you spin relatively slow, then these Hartmann-Hahn match, these conditions are very broad. So you didn't look for it, whether it should be have this difference or not. It was not important. But as soon as people started to invent higher rotors, at that time you could only spin 500 hertz or something like that. When people started to get rotors that could spin with these air bearings and things like that, they could spin thousands of hertz. Then it started to be visible that you shouldn't match the RF fields to be exactly equal. They should differ with one rotor frequency. So it's sort of, I think, an experiment that evolved as the technology evolved, and that is what we do when we spin.
But that's not what that clarifies. That's not that your goals are any different from Bynes' goals.
This is a refinement. And I didn't invent this experiment. It's just an explanation how it works. So then you have a Hamiltonian of this kind here, and you can start to say, well, this Hamiltonian obviously you should be able to explain how that transfers magnetization from one spin to another. And that is easy, well, I don't know for you, but it's easy to explain if you have a set Hamiltonian, I set a set, how that transfers magnetization from I to S. That we do in these simple three-dimensional box layers. In this case here, it looks a little bit more complicated. Your Hamiltonian looks more complicated. That was what Levin was alluding to yesterday with these zero quantum frames and double quantum frames. So this Hamiltonian here looks very much like a zero quantum operator, that is XX plus YY in NMR. This one is XY minus YX, that's a zero quantum Y operator in general. But we have sets here in instead of X's. So now what you do is that you tilt the frame around the y-axis, so you get xx and yy. So it's zero quantum operators, and they can be explained as sort of fictitious operators that only perturbs the two central energy levels. So it's sort of you have ix, iy, iz in a fictitious bin half space, and that was what Levin was talking about yesterday. So the Hamiltonian looks like this. The propagator looks like this in this fictitious space that depends on these zero quantum operators here. And now if we look at the transfer, the initial operator is IZ. That has a component that is a double quantum component and a zero quantum component. If we look at it here, if you take this zero quantum set operator here and add it with this one here, this minus cancel this plus, so you get IZ. So the starting operator contains a fictitious double quantum operator and a fictitious zero quantum operator. This Hamiltonian here influences only the zero quantum part. It can't touch the double quantum part. So what happens when we rotate here is that the sum part, the IZ plus SZ, remains. So this one is constant. But you modulate the zero quantum part. And now if you put this angle here, that is dictated by the time times this one here. If you put this angle to pi, what you get is IZ minus, IZ 1 form minus IZ 2, 3. So you take this one minus this one. This one minus this one, the I's goes out, and the S's remain. So that means you do an inversion. And that was exactly what Navin was explaining yesterday. That is a transfer using these recoupled operators here corresponds simply to an inversion in a zero quantum frame. So what you'll have is that you start up here with IZ minus SZ, and you invert this one here, and then you get a transfer from I to S, and that is done by this experiment here, where you have these two RF fields. You have these RF pulses along here that tilts the magnetization, that is the Y rotation I talked about before. Then you can say the aim here is not to bring set to set, or X to X. That is what we illustrated before. So if you repair a little bit on this one here, remove these pulses here, you have the cross-polarization experiment like Pynes. Because obviously what you want to do, you don't want to bring it into set here, you want to determine transverse magnetization. So therefore it doesn't make sense to have a Y pulse here. This one here doesn't influence anything, you can remove that. You start with I magnetization, this one doesn't matter at all. You just remove these pulses here, doesn't change anything, and you have the cross-polarization experiment invented in the 70s by Alex Pynes. So this is simply just an inversion here. So now you have, by putting on these two RF fields here in synchrony with your RF, your sample revolution here, then you have reintroduced your Doppler couplings. You can use them to transfer magnetization from spin to spin. You can also use them to measure. So I think this is an example where you put sample revolution on. That was not what Times was doing. Fast revolution, sample revolution eliminates everything. And now by adjusting, putting some simple continuous RF fields on the two channels here, matched in a certain way relative to the spinning frequency, hoopla, you get the Doppler coupling back, and you can use that for what purpose you want. And that forms the basis for multidimensional solid state and mass spectroscopy, where you do a lot of advanced, much more advanced pulse sequences. That is what we are doing. It sort of makes them more robust with respect to chemical shift offsets, and could be what we want to design is not a Hamiltonian that looks like this one here. It could be we want to have a set Hamiltonian. Could be we want it to look differently. So there's a full art that has been going on the last 20 years in designing pulse sequences that recouple in the most clever way, so we get the cleanest, most accurate information out of our spin systems. And that is very, very important, because if you don't do it, if, for example, you use this pulse sequence here to transfer magnetization between a carbon and a nitrogen, these ones, if there's a small RF luminosity or something like that, small variation in RF field, you don't get a good transfer. It's very, very sensitive to RF luminosity and offsets and things like that. So there's good reasons to try to manipulate these RF irradiation schemes so they get more robust. And that is the art
When Nadine talked about the inversion yesterday.
Yes.
So this was the step where you had to minus omega, you tried to make, and we, you talked about doing it by adiabatic passage. There was a certain step where you wanted to create the inverse of the...
That was earlier on. I didn't talk about adiabatic in this context, but people do adiabatic sweeps here.
I don't know whether the next slide actually shows that. The next slide again will show what adiabatic actually can do in this case here. The only thing I just say here now is that if you look at this process here, this inversion process here, that depends on the Doppler coupling constant. That goes here, that is the Doppler coupling that drives us. This Doppler coupling depends, I have it somewhere, but it could be I have to go far back. No, this Doppler coupling, or this coefficient here, depends not only on the Doppler coupling constant, it also depends on some Euler angles. So we don't get a perfect transfer. For a single crystallite, we get perfect transfer. But here we have to average the effect over this Euler angle here. So this inversion for different crystallites will produce a different rotation angle depending on the angle between the internuclear axis and the magnetic field. So what I want to say with this is that if we can do this with a inversion, it could be we could take inspiration from liquid state NMR, that was also what Nadine was talking about, and do a composite rotation. In liquid state NMR, there's a fantastic pulse. I should do that on the blackboard. A fantastic pulse introduced. We also discussed a little bit yesterday, introduced by Malcolm Levitt. Where you have a sphere here. And you want to have a RF rotation. You start with your IZ operator here, and you want to go down to minus IZ. You have an RF field around X, and you start to rotate. So this one here, you rotate with your RF field. If you have an inhomogeneous RF field, then it could be it reaches here for some parts of the sample. You have a coil, and then it could be you have a very high RF field here. Your RF is high. And you have a different RF field here. So it could also be there was some of the spins, this one out here, that only reached here. So you have RF homogeneity. So what he invented in the 80s, I think, was that now if you put a pulse here, a 180-degree rotation here, then this one here will be rotated like this and go down here. This one here will be rotated here and go up here. So what this 180 degree pulse was that it slowed down those that moved too fast, and it speeded up those that moved too slow. And then you do exactly the same 90 degree rotation here and continue. So this now, this one here that we know is fast, slow, this one that is slow starts from here and go full way down. This one here that is delayed goes full way down. So they end up at the same point. That's a very clever experiment. So what you have, instead of having a 90 degree, a 180 degree X, what you have is a 90 degree X, 180 degree Y, 90 degree X. Very clever experiment.
And this seems like a cousin of the spin echo.
It's a cousin of, yes. Just done in along a different axis. Yes. So one can say, well, we shouldn't point out certain persons to be clever. Everything is building on everything. So yeah, you're right. This has certainly analogies. What we want to do here is to do exactly the same, and say, if we have variations here with respect to this beta angle, that is the angle between the Doppler coupling and the magnetic field, we certainly have that. The powders have all kind of orientations. Well, why don't we do the same? And that was something we did with Navin. Was why don't we do this, that we put this extra 180 degree rotation in? We do it a little bit different ways with some triggering pulses here, but it's essentially the same. Then we can raise the efficiency of this cross-polarization experiment from 70% that is possible if we power average, we can go higher. We can go even higher if we do more sophisticated ones. So as soon as we start now to get some understanding what are we doing with these recoupling experiments, we can start to do fancy experiments. And this is one example. You can also use, that was not what I wanted. You can use optimal control to do the same sort of thing, design the pulses by optimal control. This is the DCP experiment in the case of RF nonlinearity, kills it. The Coombe sequence we had before, that was this composite sequence, which is here. If you do optimal control, you can get it up here. And then it starts to look like, in the RF picture, it looks like an adiabatic passage. And here in the recoupling frame, it looks like this. So this is more or less an adiabatic transfer in this zero quantum frame. And that is sort of new to solid state amount, that you can do the same things like this. And here, optimal control allowed us to get very, very efficient sequences. So what we did was we designed composite pulses that did this inversion for liquid state NMR, translated these into solid state NMR by just putting these correction pulses in, and then it looks like this, and we get very, very high transfer efficiency.
It's similar to adiabatic. It's
similar to, I didn't check whether it's actually fulfilling the adiabaticity rules. I just say this smooth rotation here, to me, it looks like something that, so actually that's a correct step. I don't know. It looks like something that could be adiabatic. I think it is. You don't. No, I don't.
These are solutions that came out of optimal control.
What we did with optimal control in this case here was that we could see that in it works to do an RF pulse that was 90 degree X, 180 degree Y, 90 degree X. That was a better sequence than a normal 100 degree X. So why don't we try to do with the large variations of RF in homogeneities, variation in the RF fields, optimize a pulse that do it better than this simple one here. So the only thing we did with optimal control was to say we wanted to have a pulse that was extremely robust towards RF and homogeneity. And that has to be extremely robust in the sense that here we have a very large rotation. You actually, if you look at the dipolar angles, you have some crystallites where the angle is exactly the magnetic angle relative to the static field. So you have components where the RF field, so as to say, is zero. And you have some that where the RF field has full power of the Doppler coupling. So that could be that it is 2,000 hertz. So you have to span 0 to 2,000 hertz in a wide way. So it's extreme broadband pulse. And that's difficult to do by analytical means. That's one motivation. Another thing is we also needed good examples to do optimal control on. So that would be a good case to do single pulse, single spin pulse optimal control, and transferring it to obviously more time-consuming calculations in solid state NMR, where you not only have to consider two spins, but also need to consider power averaging, things like that. So if you can just do it in a single spin liquid state NMR case and design an experiment that could be used in a double zero quantum frame to do the same in source state NMR. Obviously, it's also a numerically clever way to do it. It speeds up the calculations enormously.
I guess what I still don't understand is this is a numerical optimal solution of some type.
It's a solution that comes out from optimal control, whether it's completely optimal or not.
It's numerical.
So this is the pulse optimal control came with the given range we gave it of RF inhomogeneities. Then it suggested the pulse should look like this. So the only thing I have to do, we have to do.
So the top one you get, that was kind of your initial guess for
no, no, no. That is the result.
The top one is the result of the optimal for liquid state.
Yes, for liquid state. So the only thing it does here.
And the bottom one is for.
Battery recoupling. Okay.
It's just the same pulse, it's just different. Rather, you cannot change the phase it will, so we have to do this.
So here you see the effect here. We put on this DCP experiment. This DCP experiment follows a certain trajectory here. Different crystallites, you have two crystallite angles, the alpha, the beta, and gamma angle. So different crystallites takes different trajectories. So, but forget that now, say that we have only one trajectory here. We can take this, it should be this one here. Let's take now the DCP experiment, let it run, instead of an inversion pulse, let it run approximately 90 degrees. Then we want to use the same dipolar coupling to make 180 degree, but we can't do that by just switching the RF phase because it's the dipolar coupling. We can't switch the phase of the dipolar coupling. So we have to put in some correction pulses that it eventually turns this 90 degree. So we get a 180 degree rotation here. Then we switch it back and that's the next set of pulses here and we go down. So to translate a normal composite pulse that is 90, 180, Y, it's X here. 90x, 180y, x, we put in these correction pulses. So the only thing we had to do when translating a composite pulse in liquid state NMR into a composite pulse in solid state NMR was just to put in these small correction.
Was it those extra
ripples? So it's just a
yes.
Change of rotation of frame back orientation, but it's the same pulse.
Yes. So that's one way to design pulse sequences. Another way, but I don't know whether it's time allows, so I could show one single example more where we try to tailor our Hamiltonian. We don't want to have a Hamiltonian that contains these zero quantum terms, but we want a set Hamiltonian. Then I'll not give a talk next week because that's sort of the end. So I think that would be also be better. Exactly. So what we want to do is to design now, this is control problems that we want. We want not only to design a dipolar coupling that can make us transfer things. We actually want to be a little bit more critical. We want to have a Hamiltonian of a certain shape. How can we do this? And I showed that in the conference also, how we can do that with optimal control. What we show here is analytical. So we end up with a pulse sequence that looks like this. It's very complex. Things like this. And what is the motivation for this complexity we have on this slide here? That is what comes in the next slide here. If we do dipolar recoupling, could be we should turn off. If we do dipolar recoupling, as I showed you before, then typically we get Hamiltonians of this kind here. That is inevitable. We do around one axis, we'll always pick out two components here, a planar Hamiltonian of this kind here. That's impossible to avoid. In the homonuclear spin systems, at least. This Hamiltonian is okay, it drives transfer from one spin to another. But the problem with these Hamiltonians is if you have several spins at the same time, you have one spin that is coupled to one spin, but it's also coupled to a third spin. These Hamiltonians doesn't commute. That means eventually they decouple each other, they truncate each other. So if you have a strong Hamiltonian that has this character here, and it doesn't commute with another one that's much weaker because it's longer distance, the strong one will decouple the weak one. So that means eventually that you can measure and transfer magnetization between spins that is close, where you have a strong dipolar coupling, but they start to be invisible when you have long ones, long distances. So this success we had recoupling this one here is our graveyard in this case, that it decouples those that we're interested in. For structural biology, no one cares. Well, it could be few people does, but very few cares about the distance between two columns. It's 1.5 angstrom, and people know that that doesn't give any structure. What they're interested in is those that is long. So they want to find out what is here, what is going to the next segment of the molecule. Structural biology relies on this one. So therefore, it's a little bit sad that we have designed experiment, even used a lot of effort on it, to design experiment that kills what we want to get. Frustrating. The solution to this is to recouple an Ising Hamiltonian, a set-set Hamiltonian, because this one will commute with each other. Any pairs, it's set-set Hamiltonians, they will commute with each other. So if we can produce this one, it's very good. That is what happens when you have heteronuclear dipolar coupling interaction, for example, between a proton and a carbon. Then the chemical shift difference or the Larmor difference between the nuclei truncates away the planar terms, so you have this one here. So we know for heteronuclear cases it works. If we can just get this one, it works. But now the most abundant nuclei that is in biological solid state NMR is not protons. Well, protons is, but they're difficult to handle still. So what people do in biological solid state NMR is a carbon label. They put uniformly carbon 13 in and uniformly nitrogen 15 in to the sample. So you have a lot of carbon-carbon distances you want to get out, but you can't get them out because recoupling experiments kills the information here. So that is frustrating. And you can see the effect here that is calculated. You have one spin here that couples to this one, and it couples to this one. If you do a measurement here on the defacing of this one here in presence of these dipolar couplings here, so now if there's a dipolar coupling, this signal will deface due to evolution under this dipolar coupling. But if you do this double quantum or zero quantum sequences and look at the evolution, this signal as time goes, it doesn't deface at all. It stays up there. But if you had a set-set Hamiltonian, it'll deface. So this one here illustrates that as soon as this one is present here, you can forget everything about measuring this one here. It simply stays up here. You don't see any effect of the dipolar coupling. That is what people have in the last 20 years called the dipolar truncation problem of solid-state NMR. So our aim here is to design a Hamiltonian that is set-set rather than this one here I showed you with the design before. So this is a controlled problem. How can you do this? And we obviously have maybe him around, clever guy with good ideas. So actually what I should mention with this one here, that is people talk about doing these experiments here, but they bring magnetization up to the protons, let the magnetization diffuse among the protons and go down to the carbons. But putting a third spin in doesn't solve what we want. We want to measure accurately the distance between these two here. If you have a third spin, it depends obviously where this third spin is. Is it here or whatever? So you get an imprecise measurement in.
Does that mean that state space restriction is easier than we think? That is, the radius of that interaction sphere that we were talking about, because its dipolar truncation is smaller than the dipolar fading distance.
For homonuclear spin systems, you could say that, but what we want is to obviously get not have this truncation present. So I think somehow we shouldn't throw it away before we start.
Yes. Okay.
So what one can do about it is to design an experiment that is robotical in this case. We have a recoupling field here, a static field along this axis here. Around this one, we have a rotating field that rotates around this first axis here. Around this one, we have another rotating field here. So what we can start to do is to play a little bit more with these e to the I m omega r type of things. If we could get many rotations in, obviously get more flexibility, which terms should be e to the I zero and which should have time dependency. Those that has time dependency obviously goes away, the average away. Those that is static stays. So putting on more rotations allows us to get more flexibility. So if we want to look at this one here, we add this rotation here. This is a constant field here. We have another field here that is rotating around here. This one and the third field that goes like this. This produces a modulation of the Hamiltonian that potentially allows us to filter out this component here alone. And obviously the reason for introducing it is that that is the case. We get an Ising Hamiltonian out of this one here. The field obviously looks a little bit complicated. We have RF modulation, the RF phase, the amplitude looks like this, the phase looks like this, the offset looks like this. So what you do is you rotate with your RF sequence. You don't just have a continuous wave on, as we saw for the DCP experiment, but you have very, very complicated RF field that rotates in IX, IY, IZ frame like this one here. It actually looks amazing that that could give a useful result. But what you can see if you go into the interaction frame, if you go into the interaction frame of these two components here, you get a modulation of your dipolar coupling Hamiltonian that goes like cosine to the power 4, IZ. You've got different modulations on the other terms here. And that is exactly what you want. You want to have different modulations here. The chemical shift terms that you don't want to have recoupled have only a cosine to the power 2 dependency here. And now if you put on this decoupling field, this strong field here, it averages everything out that is in the transverse plane, you rotate here. This is a set field here. So now if you do this one here in addition, then you clean up your Hamiltonian so that you get only a cosine squared modulation IZ term for the chemical shifts here. And then you get a dipolar coupling term that is having a dependency cosine to power 4. And now if you expand these two ones, you'll see you have a cosine term here, but that gives an exponential something that here is modulating with 4T times CT, and for the chemical shift terms that you don't want anisotropic from, those modulates with half the frequency. So now if you adjust this one to 1/4 of the rotor period, so C is omega R fourth, then you get E to the I omega RT. So the only thing that survives this is the dipolar term, and you get your isotropic chemical shift, the isotropic part of the chemical shifts. So that is how the Hamiltonian looks like. Then these ones, if the isotropic chemical shift is large relative to the dipolar coupling, then these two ones modulate the transverse components here through the differential chemical shift here. Okay. Chemical shift difference here. They modulate these terms here, and what you end up with is a Hamiltonian that only contains the set terms. And that one allows us to measure long-range dipolar couplings. So by introducing and doing these controls here in an advanced way here, you can get a Hamiltonian that looks like what you want. So you modulate, you can improve all these things here, and you got a Hamiltonian that looks like. So what you had here was the RF that helped you, and the last part of it was the isotropic chemical shift that survives the sequence here. Most sequences tend to eliminate these chemical shifts here. We use the chemical shifts here to truncate further our dipolar Hamiltonian, so we get the set term. So what the art was here was to reintroduce the dipolar coupling in a clever way and at the same time maintain isotropic chemical shifts that can decouple our transverse components here. And that works in practice. I will not go through this. This is a little bit advanced. But you can use it here and look at the defacing here. In this case here, it is for this big molecule, alanine or something like that, where we look at the distance from the carbonyl here to the C-alpha and to the C-beta. The C-alpha decays very fast. There's very strong Doppler coupling. In this case, the beta goes a little bit slower. You can compare that with an experiment where you don't have this recoupling working. Reference experiment, subtract these two from each other, and then what you'll see is obviously what you want to measure is this defacing here, the difference between the one where you don't recouple and the one you recouple. So what you get out, these curves of this kind here for the alpha, for the L curves here, looks fantastic with respect to distance 1.5 angstrom. We knew that. The beta looks like this. If you go to 309, you also have a gamma. It looks very fine compared to what you'll expect. So now you can start to measure distances that goes out from in this case our carbonyl here down to valence bands with very high precision. The problem here is that we can't go further out than around 3 angstroms, 3.5 angstrom, that is not enough. And the reason for that is that we have a relatively low, by doing all these RF manipulations, we scale down our dipolar coupling. So what you can do, and that is the final slides, is that you can do a more advanced one where you rotate X, you rotate now again here, you insert an extra set rotation. This one here is inserted because the experiment we had before was exactly this one. We had a static field here, we had this component, we had this component. So the only thing we do now is add an extra set rotation here. If you do that, you can get a more complicated pulse sequence that looks like this, and you get the scaling factor up by 2.5, so now you can get up at longer distances. And the reason why that works is actually very beautiful in the sense that if you take the x rotation first, get the ZZ term here with the cosine squared, but you also get a component here that is yy with the sine squared too. If you introduce the Z rotation, you don't touch this one, so you keep this one here. So what I want to talk about here is refocusing internal parts of the Hamiltonian. So the ZZ rotates this into an XX with this sine squared. Now you go along with the Y rotation, that is the third rotation here. Then that XX has a component that goes into ZZ. So now you have two ZZ components here. So you don't have the cosine to the power 4 as we had before, but we also have this sine to the power 6. If you add these two ones here, you don't get only this 1/8 here, but you get 10 over 32 for this component that modulates with the frequency. And this coefficient here is 2.5 times bigger than this one here. And the reason for just illustrating this one here is that if you start to understand these things, how do you do these rotations, you can start to do very, very clever experiments. And I would say this one is a fantastic clever experiment. This is a refinement of it that allows us to scale up the dipolar coupling by a factor of 2.5. That means we can go for longer and longer distances.
Technical question, how do you simulate a pulse which is modulated simultaneously in amplitude, phase, and offset? I mean, what sort of function is that?
Let's finish it. So we could, the only thing I wanted to say here, we go out to now distances around 5 angstroms or something like that, and that allows us to do more advanced things in structural biology, because obviously those that is within 2 or 3 angstroms is not interesting. Those that is within 5 angstroms starts to get interesting, and we can start to use it in structural biology. So I think I'll stop here. And all these obviously collaborations with Naveen and Stefan and a whole bunch of people in my group in Aarhus, and hope I have at least given you some flavor that solid-state NMR has challenging problems by having broad lines. We can narrow them, we can reintroduce some of the interactions again, and we can start to get important information out about structure. I think there's a lot of information still to gain. Yep.
So, could you show us an optimal control problem?
These problems here.
Anything. I mean, none of it looked like, okay, there's a Hamiltonian, I'm going to. I mean, it just.
I think yes. That was the next half of it. That was optimal control. Not the next half. It was the next few slides. Obviously, all of this you can do with optimal control. What you want is a specific Hamiltonian, for example. You want to have a set Hamiltonian. You want to do that with a complex set of RF manipulations to design your desired Hamiltonian, your desired propagator. Or it could be that you want to make a transfer that goes from one spin to another spin. You'll say, this is the starting operator, this is the ending operator. We have this pulse sequence, do it in the best way. So what I'll say is that we, and I don't know, were you at the conference? You were not, we had the conference in 3 weeks ago here. No, you were not here. There was a conference here in at KITP. No. Okay, there I presented some of these things. I assumed that everyone was around there. So I focused here on the control problems. So what we can do, and I also discussed yesterday, is that we can obviously ask optimal control to help us design these experiments. And that is good for two reasons. It's good that it provides us very good sequences. I can show you, I'll not go through it, I'll just show you. Well, actually you can take this one as an example. You can obviously replace all these recoupling experiments that you have here, transferring magnetization from protons to nitrogen, from nitrogen to carbon, from carbon to carbon. You can replace all of these with optimal control sequences, and it turns out that if you do optimal control, then you get very good gains. You get higher sensitivity in all of these transfers. And higher sensitivity, that provides us gain in sensitivity in our experiments, and that is important. Solid state NMR is a low sensitivity method. So we can get substantial gains that copes with RF nonlinearity. So this DCP experiment, if you do that in homogeneous field, you get low sensitivity here. If you do it with optimal control, you repair this experiment. So you can do an optimal control variant of this one here. So you get higher sensitivity by combating the effects from RF homogeneity. So optimum control can help us there. Now, the reason for showing this exactly this graph here was what we wanted to do with these composite dipole recoupling experiments was to get higher efficiency than this by helping out this powder angle dependency we wanted to go up here. And I think what optimum control in this case told us was, well, there exist experiments here. We should look for them by analytical means because we know they are there. So why don't we go back analytically and try to design experiments that do exactly this? So I think optimum control in this case here, we have used them a lot to design specific experiments that is fantastic, important in biology to do three-dimensional spectra here that allows us to do all our assignments here. They're extremely robust, more intensity that we see in other experiments. They are very robust towards offset ranges, things, all these things. So there's a whole array of these things. What I wanted to show here in this talk here was more I wanted to emphasize the Hamiltonians, the delicate problems with time modulations, anisotropic interactions, powder spectra, all these things. Optimum control obviously can help us a lot there. So we designed many experiments. I'll be happy to show them to you. But
sounds like we could discuss this in detail. We kind of have a longer discussion about this. Except that next week is your last week, and Peter won't be here next week.
What I'm only saying is that sort of you can obviously design new pulses here by asking optimal control to do it, and we did that in many cases. The problem with this optimal control, and if you should say any problems with it, is that it works very well if you want to go from one spin that is close to another one, because you have to sort of define your spin system. In solid state NMR, I showed you this molecule with an enormous amount of interactions, all spins interacting. That's also Ilya's sort of problem with respect to everything couples. So you have somehow to focus on a certain spin system. You have to enter information about, I want to go from this spin to this spin. If you add on 20 spins, the matrices gets enormously big, and it's very, very difficult to do it numerically because it has to have a lot of information in. So I say optimal control here learned us a lot, and it is very, very important to design experiments. But so far, it has mainly been used to design experiments of local nature, because we want to have small spin systems. So we use that a lot for these direct transfers, but it's difficult to cope this problem, as I illustrated in the last slides here, where we want to measure long-range distances, because as soon as you have long-range distances, you have many spins in the interaction sphere, so as to say.
Let me try to ask, I think this may be what Peter is getting at. In the talk, your design criteria with, we're like trying to change the Hamiltonian.
Okay.
Remove terms, these terms, and to get new terms in the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
And yet when we normally formulate an optimal control problem, we formulate it in terms of some trace of the density matrix.
Yes.
So those look like
okay.
Like very different.
It's the same principle.
Yeah, we want the same.
So I think mathematically it's the same thing.
But I'd like to see, maybe you can just be a little bit more explicit about how you could. What I understood is that you did an optimal control calculation,
mm-hmm.
and you got some kind of upper bound. Which told you to look for some pulse sequences.
Well, also, obviously, we use these pulse sequences. They are used in our labs because they provide.
Okay. Right, I understand. So, but maybe you could just be a little bit more explicit about, you know, particular. Let's say you wanted to remove the y minus xx,
mm-hmm.
whatever it was, xy minus yx coupling,
yes.
yy, and you want to put the zz in there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that's your goal.
Mm-hmm.
So how would you do that? How would you write that as an optimal control problem?
Well, okay, it could be I'm not enough optimal control person to that. Okay. So I think my formulation is simple.
You can answer Rennie as an optimal control problem, but how would you express that goal in terms of some target density operator?
Well, if it's a Hamiltonian, A takes you from A to B. Hamiltonian that you want takes you from A to C. And so you are de facto going to B under the Hamiltonian you don't want, and you're going to C under the Hamiltonian that you want. So specify the goal function as the trace with the Hamiltonian, with the states, with the end states that you want,